Welcome to the Jonah Carey Podcast, friends. Thanks so much for tuning in. Today's guest is Justin Ling. Justin is one of my favorite writers. He writes for a whole bunch of different places, including formerly of Vice. He writes for The Guardian. He writes for a great publication called The Walrus. He writes for Foreign Policy. He is all over the place and an excellent writer at that. All kinds of different topics. He's a great crime writer. He gets into national security stuff, all kinds of stuff about, you know, bending truth in politics and where we stand there, Google fake news, Cambridge Analytica, stuff like that. Really, really compelling, broad range of topics, and right up my alley for a podcast conversation. You will definitely dig this chat with Justin. Check out all his work. Just Google Justin Ling. You can do all of that. He is fantastic and highly recommended, and I think you will highly enjoy this episode of the podcast. You can also follow Justin, by the way, on Twitter at Justin_Ling. That's L-I-N-G. So there you go. Get on that. You should also get on our sponsor, and that is Quip. Quip is a sponsor of this week's Jonah Carey podcast. And you know what? The truth is most of us are brushing our teeth wrong. Yeah, that's right. We're doing it wrong. Not for long enough. We forget to change our brush on time because most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing, but not Quip. So what makes Quip so different? Well, it's an electric toothbrush. It's a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes, still packing just the right amount of vibrations to help you clean your teeth. Built-in timer helps you clean for the dentist recommended 2 minutes with guiding pulses that remind you when to switch sides. Subscription plans for your health. Every 3 months, just $5, including free shipping worldwide to get new brush heads. Comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror, so that's really easy. Everybody loves Quip. You will find that you do as well. They're backed by a network of more than 20,000 dentists and hygienists, hundreds of thousands of happy brushers who use Quip every day. And get this, Quip starts at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/Jonah right now, you get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/Jonah. That's getquip.com/Jonah. Thank you to Quip for sponsoring the podcast. Hey, we got some programming notes. So, first thing to know is CBS Sports. That's where you will find most of what I do, writing, and especially CBS Sports HQ. You can check me out there frequently throughout the day. Also, you can get the best highlights and biggest sports stories right in your inbox every morning with the CBS Sports HQ newsletter, packed with all the good stuff you need to see before the start of your day. Just go to cbssports.com/HQ daily to subscribe and to watch CBS Sports HQ. You can do that on the CBS Sports page, or you can also do it on the CBS Sports app through Roku, Apple TV, anywhere you have OTT devices. Check out my smiling face talking about baseball. Check out Pete Prisco and Will Brinson on football. Check out our great basketball writers, hockey, soccer, tennis, golf, whatever you could possibly want. Get on all of that. And also I should mention, by the way, that if you check out CBS Sports, my most recent column is about Chris Davis, who is on pace to potentially have the worst season in baseball history. So that's fun. As the All-Star game is going on, and that was quite an incredible game. Wow, extra innings, lots of home runs. We've got all the greats of the game, and here we've got Chris Davis, who I wrote about a few years ago and was very impressed with all he'd done, and thoughtful guy when I spoke to him, and it's painful to watch what's happened since. And as we speak, the Orioles might be end up with Davis for many, many years to come, including paying him through 2037, but Manny Machado might be about to be gone, possibly to the Los Angeles Dodgers, so we will see how that goes. We will also see how this episode of the podcast goes. It's with Justin Ling. I hope you enjoy it. Justin Ling, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So you are one of my favorite writers. Let me just say that right off. I love
Yes, absolutely. I love the breadth of stuff that you cover. Some of it tends to clump into themes, and some of it is just kind of, this is interesting, I'm going to cover it. But it ends up being hot-button topics that I get super fired up about. So we'll jump around a little bit. Some of it is stuff that you've written for Vice, and some of it is stuff you've written for Foreign Policy and The Walrus and Guardian and everywhere. But your piece about this Tuscan program got a lot of attention. It got a lot of hits and was really interesting, and I was fascinated by it. I wanted a 12-part series on this thing because it's...
It may yet be 12 parts. I don't know. We've only done two so far, but there's probably room for 12.
Well, and it's just agitating and irritating because, you know, it's... And this podcast, my listeners are American, they're Canadian, whatever, it's all over the place. But as a Canadian who lives in Canada, it feels like Tuscan is the kind of program that the U.S. institutes, and it's horrible, and it's an infringement on civil liberties, but no, it would never cross over into other jurisdictions. But in fact, there's tons of, quote, intelligence sharing that gets done. There's tons of, you know, riskiness bordering on malfeasance that happens. So I guess maybe the easiest way to jump into it is take us through what Tuscan is and what the scope of it is, and then we can kind of go from there.
Right. So Tuscan at its root was started in 1997. It goes back, you know, two decades. Mm. And when it was first started, it was a pretty innocuous program. It was the sort of thing that I think anyone can sort of get behind. It was a list of names of known terrorists who should not be given citizenship, basically. It was distributed by the U.S. State Department to various U.S. agencies and the Canadian government. And they basically said, listen, if you get an immigration application from one of these people, we suggest you don't approve it. It was not really used as a basis of investigation. It was not used to question people at the border. It was pretty much just that. And it was, as best we can tell, you know, this is obviously all cloaked in a fair bit of secrecy. As best we can tell, it was a pretty short list. And it was not, you know, being fed into by everybody. You know, it's not like the FBI, the CIA, the NSA were all fitting into it. It was, you know, a list for the State Department. As time went on, obviously 9/11 happened, and after 9/11 there was a big conversation about watch lists, and were America's watch lists good enough? The 9/11 Commission report said, no, they weren't. Yes. So basically what started happening is the U.S. government started expanding and improving a lot of its terror watch lists, amongst them the database that fed into Tuscan. And so what is really hard to follow, even if you have all the documentation, even for, you know, the ACLU, who I spoke to for a fair bit for this story, have a hard time following how all of these pieces started moving and coming together. But the long and short of it is that by, 2012, 2013, you basically had this massive database. And being fed into it was everything from information on gangs to suspected terrorists, to people who have had conversations with suspected terrorists, yeah, to the kids of suspected terrorists, and it was being fed into by every single intelligence agency you can think of. And the problem is the list got really big. At one point, it was well over a million names on this master list, and a lot of them weren't right. A lot of the people on these lists that had no ties to terrorism whatsoever. They had their names confused with somebody else, or they were contacted by a suspected terrorist for very unrelated reasons.
Pizza.
So there's a whole bunch of reasons.
Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of reasons why you get on there. Yeah. And so one of the downstream lists from this big master list is Tuscan. Hmm. And Tuscan can be used to stop you at the border, to question you, have you get arrested. You could be have your visa denied. And more often than not, if ever, they never tell you you know, why they're doing this. They don't tell you you're on this Tuscan list. It's not like the no-fly list, which we have very kind of better rules around explanation and treatment. This list is inherently secret, yeah, which is kind of terrifying.
No, it is. And, you know, it's such a reflection of the era that we live in. And it's funny because when you look at politicians who talk about civil liberties, they almost get perceived as cranks. Now, I will preface this right off by saying that a lot of the ones that believe in civil liberties and really agitate for them have, for lack of a better term, cranky policies. Like Rand Paul in the States, he's, you know, the Ayn Rand disciple and libertarian way out on the fringe or whatever. But he's not wrong to mention that government overreach is a problem. But, you know, that's not where we're at. We're in an authoritarian era where Trump is doing this stuff, and you've got, you know, authoritarian governments elsewhere. But what's more striking to me, I think, is that it gets normalized. You know, this idea of center-left governance and, well, okay, you know, this is how we go about it, and things are fine, and it's kind and gentle and all this stuff. But somehow data collection and, you know, getting into people's lives, it doesn't really matter who's governing. Whatever nation it is, you always share information, you always do this, you always do that, because the fear of getting caught with your pants down and people dying is terrifying, and I respect that obviously you want to protect national security, but we can't seem to find the balance between the two. Is the toothpaste out of the tube? Can we ever separate these things and have civil liberties, but also, you know, protect our borders and our nations and all that stuff?
Well, I think so. I mean, it's also worth noting that this Tuscan program was operated by a number of different presidents. Most recently, the one who expanded it kind of most broadly was Barack Obama.
Yeah.
It is not a left-right issue. But, you know, I have a hard time actually accepting arguments that Tuscan stopped any – or Tuscan or tied to this kind of master database or any number one of these master lists of suspected terrorists. I have a hard time accepting that they did a significant amount to stop terror plots because the lists aren't very good. By some reports, the error rate was anywhere between 20 to 40% of the names on the list had nothing to do with terrorism. So if they're that bad, how can we put so much faith in these lists? It's security theater to a certain point. We have a bunch of names. We know those names have ties to terrorism. Therefore, we should feel very safe. The reality is the biggest threats to our security are the people who don't get on the lists. And we've seen this time and time again. We've seen this with far-right extremism, with people like Alec Manassian, the guy who was allegedly behind the Toronto van attack.
Yeah.
We've seen this for numerous terror attacks around the world, whether they're mass shootings, whether they're suicide bombings. Very often those people are not on any sort of lists. And even if they are, at a certain point, stopping them from traveling from one country to another is not the most effective way of stopping them. Actually reaching out, doing counter-radicalization, potentially doing more intense kind of personal surveillance for people who are really actual threats. You know, I'm not somebody who thinks that we shouldn't be doing any sort of intelligence or anti-terrorism work. I think we should be doing it smartly. I think, comforting ourselves by putting a bunch of names on a list and trying to interrogate, archaeology professors who once got a phone call from a guy who had a relation to another terrorist. That's not effective. That's not a useful use of resources or our time or our investigators' resources. So, I'm a big believer in doing things effectively and not just, creating this system where we're comforting ourselves because we're making kind of busy work for our investigators.
Well, and to underscore the point, it's a perfect jump off. You cited Alec Manassian. It feels like if we want to be safer, we could do worse than going after misogynists. And I mean, I want to really underscore the point here. There's a lot of mass shootings by misogynists. There's a lot of serial killings by misogynists. Manassian, goes after dozens of people just targeting women because he's decided that he hates them. I mean, this goes back to Le Pen in Montreal in 89. And just over and over, we see this. And, this thing of something happens and we say, oh, cross my fingers that the person is not Muslim, because then there's going to be, targeting, and then there's going to be retribution, and there's going to be vilification. But why the hell are we not going after wife beaters? And why the hell are we not going after, if we're going to target a segment of the community, it feels like if you're talking about actual, crimes prevented, we could do worse than to go after people who post absolute hate speech to the point of threats against women. It seems to happen time and time again.
Well, I think that's right. And I think, I think, Islamic extremism is something we need to be worried about.
Of course.
It's not the only thing we need to be worried about. I think so much of the security conversation tends to rest on the idea that the Islamic State is, the be-all and end-all of security threats. And it's not. Any good intelligence officer or, security agent will tell you exactly that. The problem is that, the public discourse around Islamic extremism feels very foreign. It feels very, far away. And it freaks people out. It's much easier to justify spending and new security measures relating to Islamic extremism than it is to to justify the same measures around, let's say, misogyny or, you know, the incel movement or the far right or the anti-immigrant community. So, you know, I think we can do both things, but we have to be kind of realistic about the actual level of threat from each one of those, sources. And we need actual sensible threat assessments, not ones based on how hysterical the public gets.
Yeah. Well, and I want to get into the Bruce MacArthur case too, which is another just crusher, devastating. And I appreciated the piece that you co-wrote, because, you know, I mentioned Lapine and we're really not, you know, in the vernacular, we're not really supposed to cite the name of the killer. It's interesting how Canada, and I lived in the States for 20 years, how the different populations go about these things to the point that the Boston Marathon bomber, one of them was on the cover of Rolling Stone. You know, and the people who ended up getting injured and or killed were obviously not on the cover of Rolling Stone. And there seems to be some attention, as far as I could tell in Canada, to trying to really focus on what were the lives of the people that we lost. And this was the story that you did. Was this a conscious effort? You said, okay, MacArthur's already getting the headlines. We're going to really talk about these eight men. And we don't know. We don't know the exact details. We don't know if MacArthur is alleged. The case is ongoing. We don't know if all eight were because of him, so forth. But did you say, this is what we need to do? Was it a matter of your assignment editor bringing it up? How did you decide to really delve into these eight disappearances over here's this one guy and it's an easy headline?
Oh, no. So this was definitely a decision made by me and my co-author, Tuten Ha.
Right.
We kind of said, you know, listen, there's been a whole lot of written about Bruce MacArthur. And the reality is he's a boring guy. You know, he is alleged to be a serial killer. That's the most exciting thing you could say about him. You know, his life was quaint. It was boring. You know, aside from one assault conviction in 2001, he did not lead an interesting life. So, you know, I saw all of these words being written about, you know, oh, his, you know, bucolic childhood and, you know, his decision to come out of the closet, you know, he's a gay man. And I kind of thought, well, you know, the lives of the men he's alleged to have killed are infinitely more interesting. They were refugees escaping conflict in Afghanistan, Sri Lanka, Turkey. You know, they were men who, you know, came to Canada, who, you know, fought with addiction, overcame addiction. You know, some of them led double lives. These were really interesting stories. So there, you know, there wasn't much of a sell needed. You know, at a certain point, you look at these stories and say, you know, these are really compelling stories. So, you know, that was all we really needed to do in order to kind of, you know, put the story together. It was a lot of work. It was about 4 months of work. Yeah. So, it was a considerable amount of, you know, reaching out to people in Sri Lanka and Afghanistan, people who didn't speak English, people who were much happier to remain hidden. But, you know, at the end of the day, I was happy with it. And, I'm not of the opinion that we should be kind of, you know, deep sixing the name of the accused here. You know, I think we need to talk about who this guy is and what led him to do what he's accused of doing. But at the same time, I think it is important to kind of balance out, you know, that with the stories of the victims as well, because I think we learned just as much about, you know, how to stop this from happening again by looking at the victims and looking how people can go missing for 8 or 5 or 4 years without anyone really noticing or doing the real work needed to solve their disappearance.
I like puzzles. I appreciate when a journalist goes after puzzles. And in this case, as you mentioned, 4 months of work here on one piece. But oftentimes what will happen in your work and just looking at the themes is you will write multiple pieces about one subject. You know, in the case of incel, it ended up being a few. You could pursue the MacArthur thread. There's a lot of things that you could do. It's a little different, I guess, when you're a freelancer because it's not, okay, well, I'm on assignment for so-and-so and I'm the crime reporter in Toronto, so if a guy kills a bunch of people in Toronto, I'm on that case for 2 weeks or whatever. So, you know, in the nuts and bolts of it, how do you decide that? How do you decide, okay, I might write five pieces about incel now that there's this one crazy guy who killed a bunch of people when you are not necessarily wedded to one publication or the other, when there's obviously lots of stuff that you could pursue, your breadth of topics is staggering and impressive. How do you say, I'm going to write five pieces about this one thing because it's interesting?
You know, it's a luck. It's luck more than anything. It's sort of, you know, it's serendipity and happenstance. I happened to be working at the Globe and Mail working on the Bruce MacArthur crime when the incel attack happened. So, you know, I was immediately running out the door to head to the hospital to try to cover, you know, the hospital's effort to save some of the victims. You know, I happened to have, you know, know something about the incel movement. You know, I look at online radicalization a lot. So, you know, the incel movement was not foreign to me, you know, even as a lot of the other journalists in the newsroom were, you know, trying to figure out who the hell these guys were. Yeah. You know, when it comes to Bruce MacArthur, you know, I'm not a crime reporter. I don't naturally, you know, seek out crime stories to go cover. It just so happened that, you know, in 2015, I started working on a story about these missing men who disappeared from Toronto's gay village. Yeah. And, you know, first started raising the idea that maybe there was a serial killer. And obviously, I unfortunately, turned out to be right. So, you know, I ended up on the story just because I was curious, you know, on this sort of long-forgotten story, you know, a handful of years ago. You know, when it comes to Tuscan, for example, it was an acronym that showed up in some access to information or freedom information documents that I got a few years ago and got curious as to what the acronym meant. So filed another freedom of information request and got back, you know, 250 pages of, you know, classified documents. Wow. About, you know, the Tuscan program. So, you know, a lot of this is just sort of, you know, my curiosity and poking at things. And then, you know, eventually they'll become news and I'll sort of, you know, dig into it. And I've been lucky because I've had a number of publications who have been very good to me and kind of have let me, you know, write these long features or series of features and have been more than happy to give me the space I need.
Well, for a non-crime writer, let me just say you fake it really well. It's really good stuff. I'm wondering too, I mean, is it curiosity that drives you in these cases? Because if I, you know, I'm thinking about being a reporter and pursuing this kind of thing. I mean, it can be crushing if you let it get to you. MacArthur's a maniac, and the poor men that he killed had tumultuous lives already, and geez, I mean, it's awful. And or people walking down the street on Finch, and they get mowed down because they have ovaries. Like, I you know, it could crack a lot of us. How do you go about it? Do you just stick to the intellectual curiosity and try to block out the horrors of it? Do you need, you know, three belts of scotch afterwards? Like, how do you deal with it as a human being with empathy?
So, you know, I've covered a bunch of kind of horrifying and terrifying cases over the years. Yeah. From like brutal murders to, you know, really, you know, unpleasant terror attacks. And I don't know, I think whether it's my brain just being really good at compartmentalizing things or, you know, me just sticking to, you know, kind of that work mode. I don't know. You know, it might come back and bite me 5 years from now. I don't know. But as of right now, you know, I think I handle it relatively well. I mean, you know, it's important to have, you know, and this is true for, you know, every journalist out there. It's important to practice self-care and, you know, make sure you're not working yourself to death and pushing yourself towards a breakdown. But honestly, just taking time off and sort of doing things that have nothing to do with serial killers or terror attacks or massive government surveillance programs, and, you know, sitting on a beach for an afternoon is, you know, pretty much basically what I need to kind of reset.
I like it. Beach, always a good philosophy. So another thread that you jumped on was lies, fake news. There's a lot of different stories that you wrote, and, you know, just going through your pieces, some of them don't even necessarily, might not have been part of the same thread, but you can piece them together. And this has become such a huge deal in the last few years. And we're going to get to each one by one. So rather than getting into one sprawling answer, let's try to tackle them one at a time. And we'll start with the story you wrote about Google. You know, and you, I love the opener because it's, you know, it's a great anecdotal lead. You're not jumping on Google. You're talking about this nut, this Canadian professor who basically espouses a bunch of conspiracy theories. Does this, and you're like, okay, this is all nonsense. And then it turns out that the traffic on his website is massive because Google's linking to it like as if it's a regular news site. How can we get Google and Facebook and the disseminators of news to stop treating the New York Times or the Guardian or Vice or whatever the same way they would crazypeople.com?
It's a good question, and I actually was in the room in November when somebody asked Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, that exact question.
Yeah.
And his answer sounded really good. You know, he kind of said, listen, we believe in free speech, we believe in freedom of the press, we don't think we're in the position of telling you which sources of news are right or fake news or are credible or not credible. And he kind of said, you know, we do believe in, you know, ranking and listing things in order of their credibility, which is, you know, Google's whole MO. That's basically what they do. You know, and that sounds really satisfying. The problem is it doesn't really work. You know, Google's algorithm prioritizes a lot of things beyond just how credible they are. A lot of people click fake news headlines because they're more sensational and satisfying and riveting than real news headlines. So you'll actually see things like Sputnik, which is a Russian propaganda outlet, you know, frequently beat out the BBC or the New York Times. You'll see the Center for Research on Globalization, this conspiracy website run out of Montreal, frequently do better than the CBC. You know, why is that? Because, you know, chemtrails and, you know, secret government cover-ups in the deep state are more exciting and more salacious for people, and they click on them. So Google needs to do a better job. I don't know what it is, to be totally honest. I mean, Google, you know, is a massive beast. I think we sort of put ourselves in this issue because we let, you know, one search giant dominate everything. I think in an ideal scenario, in a market scenario, we'd have four or five search engines, and one of them would say, listen, we're not going to list conspiracy websites as news. And, you know, maybe Google would say we're going to, and then they can kind of duke it out, and people can decide for themselves what the best search engine is. Maybe it's government regulation. Maybe the government does need to step in and say, listen, we're not going to put up with, you know, basically the people who run the internet prioritizing wild conspiracy theories and, you know, basically diluting the population because, you know, we have a role to play in making sure that they're, you know, that the news is accurate. I don't know which one it is. I can tell you that Google doesn't like any of those solutions, obviously. Yeah. They enjoy their monopoly. They want to keep it. They don't want regulation, shockingly. So I don't know what it is, to be totally honest. I can tell you that in the case of the Center for Research on Globalization, I've been learning a little bit more about them recently and can tell you that they have, whether or not the ties are direct or whether they're indirect, at least support from, you know, a Russian disinformation agency, one that specifically targeted Hillary Clinton in the last election. So, you know, the governments need to get smart on this. You know, we can't allow websites, you know, with millions of readers to go around distorting our democracy. That is going to have much worse outcomes than maybe stifling the free speech of a bunch of conspiracy theorists propped up by a foreign government.
And it feels like, you know, the first thing that I thought of when I read this was the fact-checking industry has exploded. That you've got Trump, you've got all lying. And again, there's a piece on Ontario elections. I want to save that for another question. It was really good. But there are so many people doing this that if you were to somehow transfer part of the algorithm to humans and just say, okay, this is going to be our vetting team. We're going to hire 50, whatever you want to say, truth scientists, 100, 200, 1,000, and we're going to have these people work with our algorithmians, and then we'll come up with something. It felt like that could work. But again, nothing is compelling Google to do this. There has to be a hammer. Because that, to me, that could be a very good solution. But why would Google add to their labor force when they don't need to, is sort of what it comes down to, it seems like.
Well, that's right. I mean, I spoke to Canada's Minister of Democratic Institutions a couple of months ago, and we talked about exactly this. And, you know, it was before, so it was when the government was still sort of writing up new regulations, new laws aimed specifically at tackling, you know, fake news and foreign meddling in Canadian elections. And what they, you know, what she basically told me was, you know, yeah, part of the solution does have to be managing, you know, online news sites, online search engines. The problem is they didn't do it. You know, they kind of said, you know, this is going to be part of the solution. This needs to be part of the solution. And then they just didn't do it. And I can only imagine that's because Google went to them and said, whatever you try to do, we're not going to adhere to it. So, you know, that's a big part of Google and Facebook and Twitter's response to a lot of governments who want to kind of step in and regulate them. They kind of say, listen, we're not headquartered in America, really. We're not headquartered in Canada. Our servers are in Ireland or they're in, you know, Scandinavia or wherever. And they kind of say, listen, you don't have the authority to tell us what to do. And unfortunately, governments seem to believe that line and have consistently kind of stepped back from any sort of serious regulation.
What did you learn about Cambridge Analytica when you were reporting on them? I thought that there were a bunch of interesting takeaways. I'm interested to hear your main one. I might chime in with some thoughts of my own, but that was a compelling piece too, because it didn't go the way that I thought it was. Cambridge Analytica, massive menace to society. You didn't paint it that way, which was a departure from the way a lot of other writers have done it.
Well, so I more than a year ago, spoke to somebody who was a former employee of Cambridge Analytica, and I won't go much beyond that to tell you who they are, but, you know, they basically told me, yes, these guys are running an incredibly, problematic effort to hoover up data from Facebook users. And yes, they're trying to use that data to target and micro-target ads, especially for right-wing causes. And yes, they paid somebody to, run a political survey to try to create modeling for, you know, various kind of political groups, and to even gin up the targeting even more. What he said at the end of that was, but so does everybody else, and they're not particularly good at it. And that's the big takeaway. And I think, and I predicted this, I think, in the story, and I think I was exactly right. We all focused on Cambridge Analytica so much that we ignored everybody else. The reality is Cambridge Analytica was small potatoes. There were, like, you know, they got a couple million dollars here and there from the RNC and from the Trump campaign and the Ted Cruz campaign. There is another agency that has more data, that has more money, that has more resources, more staff, and more experience, that is the official vendor of the RNC. They're a multi-million dollar targeting company. So, you know, this was all, you could not have designed this better if you were the Republican Party or the Democrat Party, which does this as well. Everyone honed in on Cambridge Analytica and threw stones and got angry, and they ignored all the other elephants in the room. And I think, you know, that is unfortunate.
One, it lets everybody else off the hook, and lets Google off the hook, and lets Facebook off the hook. It's, oh, here's right. This shadow organization. Yeah, that was frustrating to me. And it felt like this kind of packed journalism of, oh, you know, we found it. We found the magic bullet. I'm going to prepare the Pulitzer right now, as opposed to writing a nuanced piece talking about the general campaign of disinformation going on everywhere. And that brings me to the next thing, which is terrifying and horrible, which is lying in politics. And there's always been lying in politics, and we would sort of wink, wink, nudge, nudge at it in the past. But if somebody got caught in a real bald-faced lie, something that was really damaging, they'd be screwed. And boy, are we not in that era right now, starting with Trump. But I thought your piece on the Ontario elections was interesting, because again, here's genteel Canada, and it's the right wing. No, it's not. It's Andrea Horwath, who's lying too, who was a viable candidate and ended up losing to Ford. And it doesn't matter if you're right or left. There is no penalty for lying. It doesn't feel like anything you say can possibly come back to bite you. So how do we fix this? Do we as voters have to look for the candidate who always tells the truth? Is that candidate too boring to win an election now? Like, again, is this the toothpaste out of the tube and only liars are ever going to win elections, or they're only going to win elections for the next 50 years? Because it kind of sucks if that's the case.
I mean, yeah. So listen, you know, the thing I tried to get across in this piece is that there is a certain level of lying that we tolerate, right? I mean, everyone knows politicians are liars. It's the oldest trope in the book.
Yeah.
You know, politicians are fine massaging and distorting the truth for the sake of their own ends, because a lot of the time, you know, politicians need a little bit of liberty with the truth in order to get elected. You know, if the economy is running well and everything's doing all right, then the opposition parties don't really have a lot to say, do they? So they kind of need to, you know, play off fears that the economy is doing badly by sort of, you know, playing up, you know, some half-truths and a little bit of, you know, suggestive information in order to get the public on their side. We tolerate that because, you know, that is the game of politics. And is it pleasant? No. Could we do better than this? Probably. But it's normal. We've done this for decades. There's something very new happening, and it is concerning. And it's the ability of certain politicians to make up their own reality. And, you know, everyone knows Trump does this. Doug Ford, the new premier of Ontario, does this. And it's unique. And we're seeing other politicians sort of dip their toes in the water to that end as well. You know, Andrew Scheer, the leader of the Conservative Party of Canada, has been very, very happy to, you know, outright lie, misrepresent on the very basic level the government's policies, use numbers that are, you know, wildly accurate or wildly misrepresentative of the reality, and it seems like there's no consequences for it. And I guess I don't blame them for doing it. I don't think Andrew Scheer is as bad as Doug Ford. I don't think Doug Ford is as bad as Donald Trump. Yeah. But they're all playing the same game, and it is concerning. And I don't know what the solution is. For a minute, we seem to think that, you know, fact checking was the answer. You know, sort of tallying up all of their lies and, you know, ranking them from somewhere between, you know, total nonsense to somewhat nonsense to totally accurate. The fact is that doesn't work. It's not effective. It doesn't sway people. The people who want to believe the lies are going to keep believing them because it's more convenient to believe a lie told by your preferred political candidate than it is to sort of accept reality. And reality has become partisan. Even the fact check is, a seemingly a liberal, game. So, it's troubling. And, this stuff has happened on both sides. I mean, Bernie Sanders was more than happy to, wildly misrepresent reality in a lot of the same ways that Donald Trump did. Not as badly. but I don't know what the solution is. I honestly don't know. And I've been asking people this for a while. It's the same problem with, actual fake news. When a Russian disinformation agent writes a story that is completely fabricated from top to bottom, there will be people who are going to believe it, to the ends of the earth. And there's not a lot you can do to convince them it's not true. So I don't know what the solution is. I was in Kiev in Ukraine about 6 months ago, and I sat down with somebody who helped run an anti-fake news organization, an organization that was supposed to fact check and sort of go after fake news organs, especially those run by the Russian government. And I said, how are things going? And he goes, terrible. I don't believe in this anymore. I don't think this works. Wow. I don't think we're doing good. He believes in telling the truth. He believes in reporting accurately, but he doesn't see it moving the needle at all.
Yeah. I mean, it moves the needle among the whatever intellectual elites who can say, look at this, but the masses are not buying it. And the partisans are not buying it on either side of the aisle. They want what's best for them. You mentioned Ukraine. Let's get into the Baltic states a little bit. We're talking right now as we're getting ready for a NATO summit, and there's some problems, to say the least, and not the least of which is that Russia, which already, made inroads into Crimea, could go after the Baltic states, to Estonia and to Latvia and so forth. And here comes Trump partnering with Putin directly or indirectly and speaking out against NATO. Russia and NATO are obviously at odds. Are we going to have a major, major, major conflict in Eastern Europe in the very near future? Because it feels like that it's imminent and that nobody wants to stop Russia or has the ability to do so.
Probably not. Okay, but I hope not. Who's to say?
Yeah.
So here's the reality. America has, for a number of years, looked to try to pull itself out of Europe, at least to some degree. America has shouldered a disproportionate amount, considering it's not a European state, of European collective defense since the end of World War II. From the Marshall Plan to U.S. bases in Germany, Italy, and Spain, this is not a new thing. Over the last couple of years, especially as the U.S. government has sort of questioned its role as global sort of policeman, it has decided to sort of pull out of Europe bit by bit only once Europe kind of maintains its own collective defense. It would obviously still get involved if needed. NATO Article 5 provides that any NATO state must help out if there is an attack on any state within NATO. And, a lot of this was presided over by George W. Bush and Barack Obama, this desire to get Europe sort of stand up a little more and not rely on America so much.
Yeah.
This, if you've heard over the last couple of days, this 2% that Donald Trump repeats all the time, that's where this comes from. In 2014, Barack Obama in the U.S. sort of end NATO, asked all NATO member states to step up and contribute 2% of their GDP towards defense so that they could do a better job of defending themselves so America wouldn't have to. That has been happening, and it's been very, very slowly happening on a timeline that seems pretty much what NATO and the then president wanted. When Donald Trump storms in and attacks NATO as being ineffective, attacks it as being outdated, goes after European states for not being able to help themselves, suggests that America has been doing all the work. Those are all Russian narratives. Like, those are all I sat in a NATO strategic communication center in Riga, Latvia, and they walked me through the most common anti-NATO narratives, and they literally graphed them. They could show you in any given month what was the most popular one, which one was getting less popular. They could kind of tie it to certain world events. So, if there was a new NATO deployment in the Baltics, NATO is Russia-phobic. That went way up. If there was a story about U.S. warships or, you know, maybe Italian warships not functioning properly. The story was NATO, Europe can't defend itself. NATO is outdated. You can literally trace these narratives. Yeah. And now Donald Trump has taken all of them, crammed them together, and made a sandwich out of it. And that's really disconcerting. Yeah. It is a problem. At the very core of what he's saying, there is some truth. The way he's saying it and the way he's representing it is wildly inaccurate. You know, and when he says that, you know, certain nations haven't contributed their due and that they are now in arrière and that they might owe America money, that is nonsense. He doesn't seem to understand how NATO works. No one contributes dues to NATO. They contribute certain money for certain projects, and that money is allocated proportionally based on gross national income. America only pays 20% of that budget. Canada, you know, the UK pays 10% based on, you know, its GDP, basically. So, A, Donald Trump doesn't know what he's talking about. B, Donald Trump doesn't care that he doesn't know what he's talking about. And C, Donald Trump is parroting Russian talking points. Vladimir Putin must be very happy right now. You know, some of his main goals over the last couple of years have been getting back into the G8. Donald Trump is now advocating for that. It has been the weakening of NATO and, you know, the lessening of collective defense. That's happening. And the other thing is, you know, dropping of sanctions, and that may come in the near future. But, you know, back to your original question, is Russia going to incur into European or Baltic territory? Probably not. And part of that reason is because the European nations and Canada have stepped up and have started, and about a year and a half ago, launched basically a deterrence mission in the Baltics and Poland. The one in Poland is led by the Americans, but the other three are led by Canada and the other European states, Germany, Italy, France, Spain, a number of others. And it basically means that even if America, you know, pulls up roots and, you know, leaves Eastern Europe, someone else will step in. You know, Europe has, you know, thanks in some part to Barack Obama in 2014, thanks in some part to just a collective decision by the European states, have decided to do a better job of protecting themselves because they realize that America might not be there much longer.
I also want to ask you, this is a piece that's almost a year old, and it feels like this particular gentleman has lost his shine a little bit, but I appreciate his policies, and that's Jagmeet Singh. And the piece that you wrote was talking about how he wants to decriminalize. There were many things about Singh, but it talks about how he wants to decriminalize all drugs. And it's an interesting time for this kind of discussion because we're going to have full-on legalization in Canada as of October 17th of 2018. But the decriminalization of drugs has always been fascinating to me because I used to be a Glenn Greenwald reader before he went off the rails a little bit too. But this is how it goes when you're a civil liberties folk. He would write all the time about Portugal. And he would talk about how Portugal decriminalized everything and how you could have this nexus of if you were left-wing or even if you were a Cato reader and whatever you were, liberal, libertarian or whatever, that you would look at drug decriminalization and you would see positive results. That paradoxically, crime would go down because you wouldn't necessarily have the financial incentives in the same way and therefore not necessarily the violence. And I thought this was fascinating. And for the record, I'm completely for decriminalizing all drugs. I think it's great. So, you know, with somebody like Singh who's not going to win, Scheer's made inroads. We'll see who wins in Canada. But do these things stick when you have a third party with some clout that brings forth ideas that are out of the mainstream but have credibility? Is it conceivable that Trudeau could, or whoever, maybe not Scheer, but whoever wins the next election could implement things like this? Is this the kind of thing, a pie in the sky idea, or is introducing it into the discourse something that could actually lead somewhere?
I think it will lead somewhere. You know, I think Jagmeet Singh raising this idea was pretty bold, but I think it was in line with what a lot of healthcare professionals and harm reduction advocates have been saying for years. Most recently, the chief medical officer of Ontario, just in the last week, came out and said exactly that. It's time to decriminalize personal possession. This makes an enormous amount of sense. You are able to do a better job of letting people come forward with their addiction issues. You're doing a better job of letting people come forward if they fear they've overdosed. You're doing a better job of hopefully allowing harm reduction advocates test and ensure the safety of the drug supply, even if it is coming from illicit means. And that's huge. I mean, one of the main reasons for the opioid epidemic that's hit the U.S. and Canada over the last couple of years has not been that people are choosing to go out and get fentanyl. A lot of it has been due to the fact that fentanyl has seeped into the heroin supply.
Yep.
If we had a system where we could actually test and ensure that heroin was, in fact, heroin, there'd be fewer deaths. That is a fact, and we've seen that already. Ensuring a safe supply of heroin is a surefire way to stop people from dying. And if you disagree with that, you're wrong, because we already know it's true. And I'll say this, the Trudeau government has fervently said they will never decriminalize all drugs. But what they have done is sort of done it in some ways anyway. They've actually expanded and improved and basically restarted a program to allow the prescription of heroin. Doctors who are seeing, or harm reduction advocates or nurses who are seeing patients who do have addiction issues with heroin, can prescribe them safe heroin that is actually tested and proven to be safe and not contaminated with fentanyl. That is huge. That is really important. They've also talked a significant amount about harm reduction and safe consumption sites, about potential vending machines for needles and other things. Hmm. That's all great. This will not lead to the decriminalization of all drugs. At least that's what Trudeau has told me before. Nevertheless, it's a good step forward. I don't think decriminalization is going to happen in the next 5 years, maybe not the next 10 years, but I do think it will happen. I think it's the most logical solution. You know, I was actually in Portugal about 7 months ago. I've been traveling a lot this year. And, it is not a seedy underbelly. You know, no. Lisbon, there certainly is people who are selling any number of things and who will come up to you on the street and who will, ask you on hash, heroin, what have you. But it's not dangerous. Like, it's not a dangerous country. You know, there are, they do not have significant, mass poverty issues, at least not in the urban centers. We know that their HIV transmission rates have gone way down since decriminalization. We know that overdose rates have gone way down. We know that gang violence has gone way down. You name it, it's gone down. I think it's time to start talking seriously about this, but I'm not super confident that any of our leaders are going to do it. I would like them to. I think it's a worthwhile discussion. I think, for so long we've had, relative consensus on these sort of things. Sure, the NDP were in favor of decriminalizing marijuana, 10 years ago, but that was the most significant difference in these three parties when it came to harm reduction. We're seeing a better variance now, but it could be a lot better.
Well, and it goes to this idea, one of the most frustrating things, one of the most consuming things for me personally is this idea of harm reduction versus just appealing to people's fears. And you could make this case for safe sex as well. If you really want to reduce, rates of infection, teen pregnancy and so forth, just go around and hand out free condoms to everybody. They're cheap. It's not a problem. You could do it. This will never gain traction, particularly in America. In Scandinavia, it has. But there's something about that bulwark against logic that, how dare you? Then we're going to have a bunch of harlots on the street. And how dare you decriminalize these things? Because then we're going to have people killing each other for this. Like, it's so obviously wrong, and yet we can't get anywhere because the person who shouts the loudest seems to win. And it feels like a lot of the pieces that you write about is trying to fight against this shouting equals correct opinion thing, which I completely appreciate, which makes you one of my favorite writers. And I throw my hands up because I don't know how to solve this problem, because people come up to the podium and they have, sober and realistic ideas that are going to help society seem to have no shot. And I just throw my hands in the air and just say, oh, we're all screwed. I don't know what to do.
I mean, listen,
help me.
It's frustrating, but I think, there's this idea in philosophy that, political philosophy you might be familiar with. It's called the Overton window.
Of course.
And it's basically this idea that, as the debate goes on in a public realm, certain ideas or certain people can move that window and move kind of like the frame of public policy we understand either to the left or the right or forward or backward or whatever. Excuse me. So, when it comes to things like this, for so long, the Overton window has been stuck on harm reduction because people have, sort of been afraid to move off the idea that criminal justice is the only solution for drug addiction or for sex work is another great one.
Yes.
But, the more we hear people say, sex work is not an inherent problem, by decriminalizing it, we can get rid of a lot of the problems we profess to want to get rid of through criminalization, but we can do it, without putting people in jail. Drug addiction, it's the same thing. Having mandatory minimums for selling marijuana or selling MDMA or what have you, not effective. We know it's not effective, and yet we keep doing it. By having people come out and say what I just said, I think we can help move that Overton window a little bit and get people comfortable with the idea that maybe criminal justice and jails are not the solution to every social ill we don't like.
Justin Ling, I like you even 50 times more than I liked you before I actually talked to you for the first time. This has been a great conversation. I encourage people to check out your work literally everywhere, Globe and Mail, Walrus, Guardian, Foreign Policy, lots of great places. Thank you for all the work that you do, and thank you for coming on the podcast.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jonah.